Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Now, I've loved Squarespace for a long time. The first websites I ever made in the protest were Squarespace sites because everything's all in one place. You can just, it can look nice. They have all the resources for linking to things, social, all the things are there. I've loved it since I ever started making websites, 12, 13 years ago at this point. The other thing is if you have a business, Squarespace is really just the one-stop shop for you as well. Now, it gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid all in one place, from consultations, events, experiences. You can showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. And you can get paid on time with professional on-brand invoices and online payments. And it just streamlines your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools and integrated Squarespace SEO tools. So every website is optimized to be indexed with meta descriptions and auto-generated sitemap and more. So you show up more often on search engines and bring in more of your ideal customers. You can fundraise directly on your website and grow your impact with built-in donation tools too. You can create professional on-brand websites and make it easy to accept one-time or recurring contributions and easy ways to engage supporters. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/PSTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/PSTP. Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about the news from the past week with regard to race, justice, and equity. The news that you might not have heard or that you didn't hear with this lens. And then I sat down and talked to author Sandy Hudson to talk about her new book, Defund: Black Lives, Policing, and Safety for All. And yesterday was the 100th birthday of Malcolm X, and we're happy to be doing our part to move the needle forward as we talk about race and justice and liberation in this generation. Make sure to join our community on Instagram at Pod Save the People. And here we go. Well, we are back with another installment of Pod Save the People as democracy crumbles around us. But there is a vanguard of people still fighting, and we are proud to be in that vanguard. This is DeRay at DRAY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram. I'm so annoying.
Welcome back.
Yes. And I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on The Bad Place, LinkedIn, or on Spill at BossierS.
The LinkedIn is still, it just cracks me up.
I love it. I love it.
That you say that so earnestly. You're like, find me on LinkedIn. Well, there was a lot of, you know, funny stuff happening in the past week. I don't know if you saw that the largest last remaining plantation in the United States burnt to a crisp. Somebody said the promo for Sinners has been exceptional. I thought that was great. But I didn't realize that this plantation, they were doing proms there. They were doing weddings. And however it burned, it was a solid burn. I mean, it was just through and through. But I wanted to know if y'all saw it. If so, what'd you think?
I did see the news. I think my favorite part of it has been the black art that has emerged to commemorate the moment. Like, I need to get me some t-shirts with some of these pieces that people have drawn up and created in celebration. I think people have wanted a cathartic moment. And I think this feels like catharsis for a lot of people. And, you know, I appreciate always that, like, black people are always going to find, like, the joy and humor in a situation like this. So that has been really fun to watch.
Yeah. I don't know how, I don't think they had to find it. I think it was just, I think it's right there. I think it was right there. I think burning plantations is just a part of the black joy vernacular.
Yes.
Yeah, and I feel like a couple of weeks I've been talking about how there's this seems to be this kind of unaddressed rage happening culturally, and I felt like this moment let people express some of that rage and also that like irreverence to certain things. Yeah, just like irreverence to the whole American project too. I thought that was interesting to see that in motion.
I will say another story that I thought was not real until I realized it was real was those people broke out of prison in Louisiana. They, 10 of them. I was like, wow, one person breaking out is really intense. 10 people on video walking down the stairs out of the prison. And then people not, well, I think they didn't catch it for an hour. It was like an hour before they realized it. That blew my mind. It's like, y'all should just let them stay out there because they really did get away. And I felt, I don't know if you saw, but one of the guys got picked up in like full BAPE, like had a whole BAPE outfit. Mm-hmm. Another guy got picked up because he was on Instagram Live. It's like, sir, now this is why you got caught the first time. Because what were you doing on Instagram Live? And then I don't know if you saw, but the state issued a notice that said that they believe that the inmates got inside help.
Yes.
10 people. This has to be the most people ever to break out of a facility ever. Because 10 is, that's a lot of people.
7 of them, as you know, are still at large, right?
So that run, brothers, wild. Run.
But wait, it was a jail, right? So these are people who haven't been convicted yet. Is that right? Like, these are people. I just, you know, DeRay, in the, you are always pushing us to be clear on what we're talking about jail and what we're talking about prison, right? So
you're right. It was jail. I don't know why. Yes. I thought that it was prison. No, yeah, this is definitely a jail.
This is a jail. Right.
They had not been convicted.
Yes.
It was a New Orleans Justice Center complex. It was a jail.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now they are being taken to the recapture people are now being taken to Angola, which is certainly a prison.
Ooh, and a plantation, a working one.
It's it's actually 3 plantations made into one. Interesting.
Miles, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say it's interesting to think of them leaving from the jail because there lies a kind of like black political intuition. Like, I'm not going to wait for you. I know what y'all going to do. there's no faith in the system. I'm going to take my out now because there's no faith that the system is going to actually consider my freedom. So I'm going to take it out now. So I think that was a really interesting moment. And, you know, the other thing that kind of sat on me while I was watching it and watching black people celebrate it? A, 10 people leave. I want 10 more to leave. What? Yeah, just keep. Come on. Come on. We can handle you. But the other thing is how I think I never thought about it intellectually until this point, that America does not have the right to put anybody away, even the most heinous of black people. Like, there was not this kind of, and maybe this is just me maturing or moving differently politically and how I see things, so maybe that's a reflection of that, but there wasn't this fear that there were murderers or monsters going on the streets, because I'm like, there's already murderers and monsters in the White House. I'm not scared of murderers and monsters. I'm American. So if they found their way out, just like y'all found y'all way in, then we in the Wild Wild West. There just wasn't this fear that usually that comes with stories like that for me.
I think that's right. I think for a lot of people, it feels like punching back at the system and getting in a good lick, you know? The decision to write too easy on the wall, though, too easy, LOL. On the wall.
They said, let them know. Like, what were y'all thinking?
Who knows? And God bless whoever gave them help internally, because baby, you finna be in Angola with them, unfortunately.
But that's a deep reflection of like irreverence as like Black nihilism, right? Like the I don't know, something about writing it, them knowing that they might get caught going on Instagram Live. This doesn't seem to me, that doesn't measure stupidity, that measures the irreverence and the nihilism of it all. It's too easy. I'm gonna do it. My life is already what it is. The system's already what it is. So I'm gonna do the most interesting thing while what it is. Y'all were already gonna exploit me for slave labor in some way. So I'm gonna have more fun. And there's still seven large.
Two things come to mind. One, Miles, is I think what you said is such an interesting point to just like double click on, is that this question of like who is a criminal is just so interesting right now, because you get Trump is literally rounding people up and sending them to a maximum security facility in El Salvador. No proof, total violation of the law, like making up images, da da da. Like, and he is a convicted felon in and of himself, but the acts that we are watching happen are criminal acts. Like, they are, that is not, you can't do that. And yet he is sitting in the White House, cracking jokes. There's no fear of accountability. It is just rough and tumble. And then you get these people in Louisiana, and it's this idea that like, wow, they must have done something bad. And you're like, well, what's the bar for doing something bad today? Because we are watching it happen on national television and Politico is laughing about it. So there's that. And the second thing is, at work, we were doing something on parole, and we talked to the chair of a parole board in a state in middle America. He was a pastor. He just sort of became the chair of the parole board, didn't come from criminal justice, da da da, was super progressive as the parole board person. But our team met with him, and I was like, well, what was your biggest takeaway from running the parole board? He eventually got kicked off the parole board because he would not let people get sentenced to death. He would grant them parole. He just refused to let them get sentenced to death. And it was a white pastor. The governor was like, you got to go. So he gets kicked off the parole board. And I asked him, like, what was the biggest aha moment for you? And he was like, DeRay, he was like, as like a pastor and community, and somebody just saw everything on TV, he was like, I thought it was fair. And he was like, as a member of the parole board, I'm sitting in these hearings. And he's like, I just didn't understand how unfair the entire thing was. So he's like, I could not have the power I had and let people die inside these facilities when I knew it wasn't fair. He's like, I'm watching it happen. I'm a part of it. And it just was the most unfair thing I had ever seen with my own eyes. And it always stuck with me because he was like one of the good guys who, like, you know, he's like, I believe in justice, da-da, but he's like, I'm in the room and I'm reading the cases. And he's like, none of this is fair. He's like, the whole thing. So eventually he had a colleague who she was progressive and fair too, but she would not vote for parole on some things. It was so intense that the district attorney sued her. They sued her because she would not deny people's parole. I'm like, wow, this is wild. But it makes me think of this question of like, the thing is unfair, and our knee-jerk reactions be like, they must have done something wrong. They broke out. And you're like, y'all, if the question is who is a criminal, yeah, we rounding up a whole lot of people that are on TV and are in boardrooms. And if that's the question, it's a whole different makeup.
I think that's the moment, right, that we're in, is that it's not really about right or wrong anymore. That's all thrown out. I think that's what's so interesting about Trump eras, unfortunately, that we have to say plural, is that it actually shows, you know, morality has always been used in order to reinforce racial hierarchy. So, but if Black people can be bad and white people can be good, it works. But now when Trump happens, because he's somebody who raped somebody in the Bergdorf, allegedly, you know, he owes that woman money. Like, you know, then it becomes, oh no, it's not about who's right or who's wrong. You know what it's about who's white and who's not, who's useful in their whiteness and who's not. Are you poor and white and doing crimes? go to jail. You rich and white and doing crimes, we got a spot on you in the Board of Education. That's like, that's what we're seeing, that this, the power dynamics a little bit more, in my opinion, when Trump's in office.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, I remember when I was a kid growing up, the conversation about mental health was not great. There's a lot of stigma about it. And, you know, people didn't go to therapy because there was like shame about going to therapy. And you should just be able to pray and figure it out. And ta-da. I'm so happy that that is not where we are. That people now understand the importance of therapy, that it is mainstream to talk about us needing support and help, that that is a healthy thing. Now, there's still some work to be done because in a recent survey, 26% of Americans who participated said that they have avoided seeking mental health support due to fear of judgment. We got to work on that, y'all. I don't want you to be one of those 26% because I know that when people hesitate to get help, it doesn't just affect them. It affects all the people around them, the people they love, the people they work with, whole communities. And this Mental Health Awareness Month, let's encourage everybody to take care of their well-being and let's break the stigma. The world is better when people are happy and healthy. I love therapy. Been a big change for me because it's the one place where I get to talk to somebody who's not a part of my life. I have such incredible friends and they are amazing and they're part of my life. So if I complain to from one or if I process it from one, then they remember it and, you know, they're a part of my day-to-day. Whereas my therapist, not a part of my day-to-day. So I get to go there and just talk about the world and not have to worry about the person being one of the characters in the story that I'm putting together. And I didn't appreciate how important that is, just to have a place to go to just let it all out. Huge for me. And I'll tell you, BetterHelp creates great access for people because they have over 10 years of experience matching people with the right therapist from their diverse network of more than 30,000 licensed therapists with a wide range of specialties. And BetterHelp is fully online, which makes therapy affordable and convenient, and they serve over 5 million people worldwide. And you can easily switch therapists anytime at no extra cost. Visit betterhelp.com/people to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at Menards.
I don't know if you knew, but shout out to Black History. It's 100 years of Malcolm X's birthday. So this would be his 100th birthday. And wanted to just give Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, a shout out. Our Black Shining Prince, as he was called at the eulogy. And that era of Blackness, just really, I'm happy that we have not forgotten. I'm happy that it is a part of the Black archive and the Black memory work that is happening. So shout out to...
I think two of my favorite pieces to read actually are by Ozzie Davis and his reflections on Malcolm X. I think, DeRay, you hinted at this or referenced this, is I thought the eulogy he delivered at Malcolm's funeral was beautiful. But he also, because he was seen as a safe Black man, got lots of questions from people about why he chose to eulogize Malcolm X, right? And I think what he says in defense of that decision is some of the most compelling writing, but also so illuminating about the impact that Malcolm had on everyone's consciousness that, like, I go back to it often. And I think... a couple of things that I want to share. I'm going to pull a page out of Miles's books and just like read a couple of things to you all, right? And the first thing that always struck me about this is when he says, "You may anticipate my defense somewhat by considering the following fact: no Negro has yet asked me that question." And it's just so clear that everyone understood, wherever they were on Malcolm and his politics, why Ozzie would make the decision to eulogize him, right? And then I think this is, really, really moving to me, feels vulnerable and feels risky for Ossie Davis to say, again, at the height of his fame. And I'm going to read this last piece to you, but it says, "And if to protect my relations with the many good white folks who made it possible for me to earn a fairly good living in the entertainment industry, I was too chicken, too cautious to admit that fact when he was alive, I thought at least that now, when all the white folks were safe from him at last, I could be honest with myself enough to lift my hat for one final salute to that brave, black, ironic gallantry, which was his style and hallmark, that shocking zing of fire and be damned to you so absolutely absent in every other Negro man I know, which brought him too soon to his death." And I just thought it was beautiful. Just again, defense of his decision, but also so illuminating about what Malcolm meant to him and to so many other people.
I think I might disagree, which is like so surprising, right? With shocker. I think I might disagree with the idea that Malcolm X is still in our memory. I don't think he's in our memory. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Malcolm X and his layers are in our memory anymore. And I think that's what's so interesting about being in a white supremacist culture is that we can just the white supremacist culture could just show you something and you think it's still there, but the actual essence of Malcolm X's ideas around self-reliance, of course, when we really talk about self-defense, but sometimes he just gets reduced to this person who says, if white people hit me, I'm going to hit them back, or I'm going to be confrontational, oppositional to white people. But there was a whole idea and intellectual framework that Malcolm X introduced around self-reliance that has but been disappeared, you know, that but been reduced. When you think that you can go in, quote Malcolm X, to this corporation or at this red carpet, you done lost the plot. you don't really understand the self-reliance. And I think, unfortunately, when we see people like Malcolm X, but also when we see people like Fannie Lou Hamer now and Nina Simone now and Martin Luther King now, they have been so removed from their radical intellectual ideas. And then when we do play with those radical intellectual ideas, we make them seem like, oh, that's just a product from the 50s or 60s, something that needed to be done then. And we're noticing that right now, it needs to be done right now because we're still not a self-reliant racial group. And we still need to employ those ideas. And I think, I just think that us kind of reducing and flattening him makes it so we don't have more progressive boundary pushing conversations about Black destiny.
I do think, too, that it is a generational thing. I get really worried about the generation in school now and the generation after all of us, about what they learn. You know, Black History Month, I feel like I learned so much in Black History Month growing up. Yes. Like, whether I wanted to or not, I just learned a lot about a small set of people. Mm-hmm. And today I asked my niece and nephew, and they are learning maybe Malcolm, maybe Martin, maybe. Like, it's given maybe Martin Luther King. In nobody else. And that is wild to me to think about.
We still didn't learn Martin for real. I feel like I didn't learn.
I learned Martin.
I feel like we didn't learn
for
Martin.
Real, for real.
Yeah, we didn't learn Martin until we were in our 20s. I didn't really know what Martin was talking.
So like Radical Martin.
The only Martin was the Radical Martin. That's what's good. The Martin that McDonald's picked is a made up Martin. Once you're a dead end, but listen, like once you're a dead and gone Negro, then we can erect you. We could put embalming fluid in your body, erect you, and put a whole bunch of words in your mouth and images, and now you become a mascot for American destiny and how great and diverse and moral America is. But there was only one Martin, and it was a radical one. There was only one Malcolm, and there's a radical one. So I think we're always going to have to do the work, even if they were talking about all of the Black icons in school. I think you always have to do the work as parents, as community, as friends, as uncles, as aunts, of letting kids know this is what this person actually stood for. And you're always going to get the diet version when you go to a school because it always got to be green lit by racists.
I don't know. I got an age appropriate Radical Martin. I did. It was age appropriate. So it was like he fought the white people to protect the Black people. I got that one as a kid. Yeah. I went to Weepals. Yeah,
I don't know if that I that is such a flat way of seeing what Martin did. And I really just kind of push back on that really being teaching something. I think that is show. I just think that showing somebody history, I think that if you're just showing people history and what's happened and you consider that teaching, that's fine. But when you really get somebody to consult and to engage with that, what person actually said and what they actually thought, whether you like it or not, you know, I learned Marxism because I had read it and I consult. I didn't just see Karl Marx on the t-shirt and say this was cool or just know he did a thing. I had to learn how he thought, and we just don't do that with Black people and Black leaders. We don't engage with how they actually thought.
I wholeheartedly disagree.
Or we flatten
it. I think there's a tradition of Black teachers who have done this work for generations and continue to do it. I don't think we do it at scale, but I think that there are age-appropriate ways that teachers have done this for a long time. And I think that you are wrong. That's the best way I can say it. I think Black teachers have been doing this for a long time and continue to.
As a person who was certified to teach social studies in 3 states in the United States, I can tell you what the standards say we should teach about Martin and Malcolm. And that is that we construct them as being polar opposites, with Martin definitely being the one that we are supposed to uphold as the example of like what a real civil rights icon should be. And Malcolm being the troublesome one who couldn't learn better for his own good, right? And I think we also have to remember that the teaching corps in this country is overwhelmingly white women, right? And so where some of us were lucky enough to have educators in our lives who were Black or who were radical or who were both, the vast majority of young people in this country do not get that exposure in their classrooms and are not expected to get that exposure, because when they sit for state tests, they're supposed to say Martin Luther King Jr. was great and he was so nice and he believed in multiracial solidarity and, you know, he was nice to the white people. And unfortunately, one of them who was a lone wolf and out there on his own killed him, right? They're not supposed to notice any of the systemic or structural things around either of them, or even the construction of the two of them as...
got him killed was his interest in communism, was his interest in economic pushing against right. economic powers of the federal government. Like, that's also what got him killed. Like all of that not discussed.
But Sharada, you don't think there are teachers doing this work age appropriate?
I'm the one who said that. So anytime I'm talking about anything on here, but specifically stuff like this, I am sure there are some great teachers. Just like I know when Frederick Douglass, he came up on a great teacher, right? I'm like, in every era, there are people who are going to do radical teaching, and that is such a great work to be able to infiltrate a conservative, neo-fascist system and be able to say, no, I'm going to teach my kids the real truth about Malcolm X, the real truth about Martin Luther King. Yes, I'm sure that has happened many times over. And I've had Miss Robinson, shout out to Miss Robinson in my sixth grade class. I've had so many teachers who have been that guiding light for me. But if that's not the standard, then that can't be the expectation. And that feels wrong and dishonest to make it seem like something that maybe a lot of teachers are doing, when I know that's not the standard of most education. Just even just me being in Georgia, I'm like, that's just privilege to be able to have a Black teacher teaching you about something, or a white teacher who cares about that history. That's just extreme. That's just intellectual privilege. And shout out to the people who got it. But that's just not what's going on.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say is my grandparents used to buy those like encyclopedias and those like the Almanac of Black History and blah, 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 blah. Right. And so we always had those in our homes. And I think, you know, Dorota, your point, what your nieces and nephews are getting exposed to, you know, I mean, your sister's an educator, so it might be slightly different, but like none of my siblings are buying those almanacs or encyclopedias these days. Right. So my nieces and nephews, outside of when they might pull something off my bookshelf, are also not getting exposed to those ideas at home, you know?
Yeah, I just don't know. I think that just because the U.S. education apparatus at large isn't doing something, that it doesn't matter, I think is a big statement. I think that the tradition of Black teachers doing this for generations is actually like a noteworthy thing, is politically powerful. There is no Black freedom movement without Black teachers doing this work. There is no, like, those things don't exist without Black teachers teaching this history, is my point.
Can I give a shout out actually before we move on to an organization called Faith in Florida that is teaching Black history in churches in Florida as part of a resistance movement? And so I just want to say shout out to those folks who are keeping the Black radical and Black radical tradition especially alive and leveraging their access to people through homes and houses of worship to do it. So shout out to the folks at Faith in Florida.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Now, summer is just around the corner, and the folks at Mint Mobile have a hot take. Getting a summer bod is out, and getting your savings bod is in. This spring and summer, we want skimpy wireless bills and fat wallets. And with premium wireless plans for just $15 a month, you can have both without breaking a sweat or the bank. Now, you probably haven't even thought about a new cell phone provider in a long time because a lot of us have had cell phones forever. So you don't even realize you're being charged an arm and a leg, that there are different options out there. And Mint Mobile is a great option because the plans are so affordable. You can say bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages because Mint Mobile is here to rescue you. All the plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. And you can just ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. This year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get your summer savings and shop premium wireless plans at mintmobile.com/PSTP. That's mintmobile.com/PSTP. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
All right, my news is about the state of retirement or Social Security in this country. This year, an additional 276,000 retirees claimed their Social Security benefits early, and that is a 13% jump from the same period of time last year. And part of the reason that we're seeing this is people are nervous about the cuts to the Social Security Administration that DOGE is leading. I think people are also worried that this, you know, fiscal cliff that we've anticipated that Social Security will hit at some point might be on the more immediate horizon. And so folks are trying to take advantage of their retirement benefits earlier. But there are consequences to that, right? So, for instance, if you take your benefits at 62 instead of 67, which is considered the age of full retirement, then your lifetime payment ends up being something like 30% lower. But if you can hold out, if you have enough savings or enough, you know, ability to do it, and after you reach your full retirement age, then the benefit amount that you would receive rises 8% between, you know, age 67 and 70. So there are real consequences to people feeling like they need to take their retirement benefits early, both in terms of like how much they get in benefits over the course of their lifetimes, but also it feels like we're witnessing a little bit of a run on Social Security, right? Which as someone who is 41, I'm like, is this going to be here when I need it? But I think a significant uptick like that is also probably a canary in some other coal mine that we should be paying attention to. And so I wanted to bring that to the pod, I think, especially as many of us, at least millennials, have parents who are nearing retirement or in this phase of life, as they think about tapping into these benefits, what that means. And people are living longer, right? And how we can support people either in being able to live high quality later years, or how we support them if they feel the need to tap into their retirement benefits early for a host of reasons.
It's obviously, when I hear things about Social Security, I think a little narcissistically around it, because it is something that I have a lot of doubt is going to be there. But when I read the article, I'm like, I think my response was like, we're wondering, like, obviously that seems like such a human logical reaction to what's going on. But when I do think about Social Security specifically, because I've just been on this binge of watching so many older Black people, so many poor Black people having to, like, reestablish what they thought their retirement was going to look like. So that's what got me into, and some of it is burst really beautiful. Like, I think her name is Miss Bohemian Soul, and she talks about her, she's been featured in Essence, and she talks about her tiny home living, and she does a lot of classes and a lot of talks around older Black people, older women, and just people in general, Black people in general, maybe considering this as a way, a pathway to retirement. And then also, I see some other things that are not as beautiful, like viral TikTok videos and YouTube shorts around Black people living in storages, Black people living in different homeless, living a homeless lifestyle in so many different ways, whether it's a bus, a storage, whatever. And some of them look like hippie and bohemian, and some of them look just, it just looks sad. And I guess my problem with this, and I got in an argument with this with my mom, who's a boomer, who's retired too, is my problem with this moment is to hear boomers are often doing what they always do, which is, of course, like, thinking about themselves and kind of like trying to figure those things out. But my thing is, if you're a white, and I'm just thinking about the man who was on this cover article, but if you're a white man who has some retirement and you are seeing that that's at chance, I cannot wait for the day that your reaction is, what about the 30-year-old? What about the 25-year-old? Like, we're still in this, like, such a me situation that, I don't know. I just think that this article, and maybe because it's kind of like fuck New York Times for me, but I just think this article is framed in such a way that I don't know. Like, I'm just like, okay, here it is, this white man who's in this situation that happened because of the culture that he benefited from. And when that culture decides to bite you, then we're supposed to have some type of illumination about it. And I don't.
I'll just echo what you all said about Social Security. I think that what I'm reminded of is, I do think the storytelling on the left, we got to get it better and da 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 da. I don't know how you storytell well when the other side is just lying about everything. That's a hard thing. The story, you can talk about good stories when you both operate in good faith. That's a different thing to operate in bad faith. And the bad faith that the right is operating on is fraud. So people generally are like, old people need to be able to retire. You paid into Social Security your entire life. So it's not, you just get your, at best, you're getting your money back. At worst, you're not getting enough of your money back, right? So, like, you've been paying into this our entire lives because Social Security came up in the 30s. So we, you know, there might be a generation of people alive. There is a generation. There's a set of people who are alive pre-Social Security, but they are the vast minority. But, you know, when Trump gets elected, Doge makes the claim that there is massive fraud. They do this whole thing, 110,000 cases of fraud we're going to review, boom, boom, body, body, body. Do you know how many cases of fraud they found? Do either one of you know this? Out of the 110,000? They found two. But they talked about this fraud thing on every Sunday news, nightly news. The two was a random article in the middle of the night when somebody was like, oh, they only found two cases of fraud. And you're like, this is the same thing with voter ID. The people committing voter fraud are the Republicans. You're like, it's not even the Democrats. Do you know what I mean? The welfare mob, like, they concoct these images of fraud to create the storytelling narrative that allows for these wild changes to happen. And then you get screwed, and it was all one big lie. And I don't know what I don't know what the answer to that is, but I'm reminded that the agenda is impossible without them lying. Like, it doesn't work. If people knew you were just taking people's retirement away, that would be unbelievably unpopular. But if you are solving fraud, and the byproduct of solving fraud is that all these people come off of it, people are like, oh, well, you're getting rid of fraud. And you're like, it was two people, and they probably were mistakes. It probably was like somebody's grandmother typing the wrong number in the box. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, Social Security was always a Ponzi scheme, right? And it was a Ponzi scheme that was designed to, like, leave Black people out of it because of the roles that we were in historically. I also think about the fact that, you know, waiting until you're 70 to receive the full benefits, knowing what we know about Black life expectancy in this country, also means that Black people were never meant to benefit from this system, right? Like, none of my grandmothers made it to 65, right? And I think about that too. But as I think about and hope to make it to 65 and to 70, right? Like, what my options are for like being able to live just a basic quality of life in this culture. And like 30 years is going to be here sooner than I know it. And if that's not the case, right, if Social Security needs to be revamped, reworked, which is something that both major parties have talked about for various reasons, like, I'm going to say this, Miles, please. What is the Democrats' plan and vision for how they support people in, I saw your eye twitch, I knew it, right? in being able to retire again and like, yeah, and retire with dignity.
I think one thing the Democratic Party can do in the, you know, 75 years and when their next president cycle will be probably. I think showing
that was well played.
I think showing real initiative around these alternative home things, you know, the container homes, the tiny homes. I'm gonna be honest with you, I was a little ignorant to how expansive this is, how so many states make it so it's not easy for people to be able to have these alternative homes, how some of the alternative homes where you can be based in, they're RV camps, and the type of white people who are often in RV camps are the type of white people who are racist or senators or could be senators and stuff. And then to DeRay's point, well, when you were talking about voter suppression and stuff, the right's plan is always to call emergency on a place that they want to seize power on. So, oh, we want to be able to get, we want to be able to manipulate the vote. So here it go, voter fraud. Oh, we want to be able to relocate this money that's happening in Social Security and we don't need your problems. Okay, Elon, go figure out fraud in air quotes. And that's always their game plan. It's disgusting and a little brilliant. My news is just insanity. So every single week, we all come up with our own news story. And this week, I was not the best at my job because my laptop has been out of commission. My phone has been wild, too. So my homegirl, Sharonda, has hooked me up. And when I asked Sharonda to give me some news stories, and she gave me this story, I thought to myself, Sharonda, you want me to get laughed at. This is what you're trying to do. You want me to be talking about a fake story and get laughed at. And then I read it and it's New York Times certified and whatever that means anymore, but it's New York Times certified and it's a real story. So I'm going to read a little piece of it and give you my opinions. So the top of the article reads, the Department of Homeland Security is considering taking part in a television show that would have immigrants go through a series of challenges to get American citizenship, officials said on Friday. The challenges would be based on various American traditions and customs, said Trisha McLaughlin. A joke. A spokeswoman for the agency, she said the department was still reviewing the idea, which was pitched by a producer named Rob W. The pitch generally was a celebration of being an American and what a privilege it is to be able to be a citizen of the United States of America. Ms. McLaughlin said it's important to revive civic duty. So a couple of things. Obviously, the Hunger Games, Squid Game correlation is there. But then also I think about, maybe because I'm having so many Apple hardware software problems this past week, I also think of white supremacy and domination as these technologies that need updating. And how I note that is that the humiliation that was with the lynching postcards is still here in this. So not only do you have to prove to me intellectually that you want to be an American, but you also have to demonstrate some subservient humiliation ritual that's going to be on a television show to A, show your desperation, and then also so we can laugh at you. So even when you assimilate into this, you will be in social position as somebody who had to beg to be here, while I was in the social position as somebody who was birthed to be here. And I think that that cruelty, that taste for humiliation is just so consistent and so laughable. There's actually, I don't know if you all saw the movie Sorry to Bother You. There's actually there's actually game shows within that movie that replicate this, which I think is just so interesting. And I guess the last thing that I'll say around this like whole situation is that it's designed to distract you. Here's the genius to me of Trump. This moment, this news is obviously designed to distract you. You can kind of smell it based off of how they're talking about it, how they're talking about it, almost to like poke a little liberal bear. Like, come on, Libby, get mad. The other thing is, you also can't really afford to not look at it, because if you don't look at the distraction and denounce it, critique it, get people riled up around it, this is something that can really happen. There's actually, didn't Trump just buy a television network, or isn't there like now like a Republican television network? I know that there is one. I just don't have the details around it. But this actually can happen. So it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you don't talk about it, then you're actually creating a pathway for it to actually happen. And if you do talk about it, you're not talking about the monstrous other things that feel more urgent to talk about. And again, evil, a little brilliant, all races. What y'all think?
You know, Miles, you just made me think this could be news in another day, but I don't know. It just came out 2 days ago. Is that Verizon just acquired Frontier Communications and a $20 billion deal that the FCC just approved? Part of the condition for the FCC approving it is that they had to commit to end all DEI. And I'm like, that is wild. Like, that is like a part of the deal that Verizon has to phase out all diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Miles, I second everything you say. The other thing that I think of with this that is so sneaky, doesn't do enough work for me, like insidious, is that this is also how you take people's humanity away. Like, you gamify everything about their experience. So people who are immigrants and are not really, they're just like pawns in a game. They like literally become pawns in a game. They're not people anymore. They don't have families. They don't have lives of their own. They are just like pieces on a chessboard to be moved around. But it looks like reality TV show and it looks like entertainment. You're like, no, this is actually a way in the American context that is like palatable to take people's humanity from them. And that is what makes this so dangerous to me.
Ditto. It's disgusting, you know? And I worry, you know, that the folks on the right own so many media and communications channels that whatever we do, right, unfortunately, something like this is likely to see the light of day. And I think, to Miles's point, will be a scarlet letter and create a second tier of, you know, citizenship for the folks who participate.
Oh, well, because you said something in the gamify that was so good, DeRay, because I think about how we massage ourselves into being able to accept this kind of stuff, because I think the same thing about the popping balloons game. I think about what does it mean for Black people when our first engagement with America was on an auction block, being judged, oiled up, and being judged. What does it mean for us to recreate that for our own entertainment? Black people watching that. What does that mean? And so much of that is happening in all types of racial groups in America. So it's just interesting to think how we massage ourselves into accepting neoliberal fascism.
My news, in this vein, and all hope is not lost to me, because the one thing that the right doesn't own, that Trump doesn't own, is community. That, like, if organizers can figure out how to go back to organizing that is not dependent on the internet, like solely dependent on the internet, I think we win this game 10 times over. Like, it just, there's, because you start doing this stuff in the room and they sound crazy and people are like, yeah, we don't want that. Now, how do you get people in the room when you're competing with so many eyes and da-da-da? I don't know. I mean, I do know. That's part of my work. How do you scale it is sort of the question, right? But my news is about a continuation of what happened when Mayor Ross Baraka, the mayor of Newark, got arrested outside of the ICE facility. The woman who is the spokesperson, Miss McLaughlin, at the Department of Homeland Security, who is a joker, if I've ever seen a joker, she is on the news, and she is literally insisting that the members of Congress quote, body slammed ICE officers. Now, there are two things about this that I think are really interesting. And I don't know if you all knew this. This also could be a piece of news in another time on the podcast. But to charge a federal official with a crime, the U.S. attorneys used to have to check in with the public integrity unit of the Attorney General's office in Washington. Trump appears to be lifting that requirement. So any U.S. attorney in the United States will be able to charge an elected official with a crime just on their own auspices. There will be no check to just make sure it's not political retaliation, stuff like that. But what is fascinating about this, one is there are a set of political leaders who did not back us up around the police stuff. When we like the police aligned, they just doing their jobs, Now you have ICE being like, you Congress people, you mayor, you body slammed us. It did not happen. The body slamming didn't happen. And there's this question of like, who is, even the elected officials are really interesting because they are criticizing the department and not really criticizing sort of the officers or the underbelly of policing that allows for them to make these wild claims. And the camera is so clearly not showing that. So that's one. But the second sort of macro point that I think is just really important in this moment around power is that part of the way, just like with the gamifying, part of what the request is from them is to deny your own eyes. They are trying to replace what you see with what they tell you you saw. Like that is a part of the game. And we can be seduced into that, partly because our entertainment world does that to us all the time. Like you didn't really read the article. You just read the headline. You didn't really see the whole thing. You saw the clip. So there are a host of things that we've been trained to like just take somebody else's word for it. Like that is, you know, I don't know if that existed in the same way before sort of things going viral and in the way that it does now. But I even have to be like, did that really? Like, let me listen to the whole thing. Or like, I think about Cassie and Diddy. You're like, did Cassie actually say that? Like, Cassie did not say that. Now, you twisted it in So we have to go back and read the things. But this is interesting because even when confronted with the video, McLaughlin is straight up like, no, they body slammed the officers. And there is something about like continuing the lie that is a form of power and telling the lie so straight faced that you start to believe that you got it wrong. And obviously we will call that gaslighting in another context, but it is as a political strategy, it's interesting because you can only do that when you have an absolute absence of shame. And I'm fascinated by it. I'm appalled by it. It is interesting to see the police state use against people who did not necessarily believe us about the dangers of the police state. And, you know, I was on a panel the other day around policing, and one of the people asked, like, what do you think is going to happen with ICE and da-da? And what's true is that the police don't solve a lot of crimes. They don't, like, in general. They just don't solve a lot of crimes. They will solve no crimes if people don't call the police. And I think that the average citizen will not differentiate between ICE and their local police department. The police will become the police to people when you start pulling people over and arresting people. And if people in communities start to believe in the police any less and just do not cooperate around witnesses or it will be a wilder day in communities because the police can't solve a single crime without people proactively coming to the police or calling 911, which I do think will not last long with ICE wrecking havoc.
So this is, I've been thinking all week about how to like, about this idea, and I was hoping that it wouldn't come up during this podcast. But so one of the things around the culture that we're in right now that I notice a lot of people who are on the more liberal side of media consumption and even just thinking or progressive, whatever, the left side of all this other stuff, is that when they see moments like that, they don't seem to me as if they fully understand the game. Like, that woman is not saying that you don't believe your eyes. You understand? Like to me, she's not saying that. To me, what she's saying to the racists who are watching her is, I am willing to be this oppositional to media, to DEI, to Black people, to whatever, that I will lie about what I'm seeing in order to to be in power in order to empower you. Like, that to me is what the lying's about. It's not about making gaslighting black people. That is a byproduct that is good for them, but it's really about that person in middle America who's racist, who knows that person is looking for me, or it's about that white supremacist black person. I'm not just trying to point out any one identity, but it's about those people knowing that no matter what those baby blood drinkers are saying, you'll say whatever gets us to the next point of power, and you're not going to let something as little as the truth stop you from this new vision of a new conservative state that we want.
Yeah, I think that was brilliantly said. That's all I got.
I love that, Miles. I think that's true. I think maybe to me it's a both thing, and I do think it is a. I think that she is speaking to people who have not seen the video and sort of introducing doubt to say, like, no, they probably did do it. Like, no, and because she's saying it so like strong though, that
and an assumption that they won't watch it, that they won't confirm for themselves.
Yeah, why would the government lie to you? She's the Department of Homeland Security. Like, yeah. That feels crazy. But you do introduce this thing. I think you are right that it is also signaling to her base, like, don't even worry. I will give me all the proof in the world and still I got you. Which is such a reminder of the Thomas Slater, like, proof doesn't matter. It is actually what I just say. I think that that is fascinating. And I think that read is great. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mosh. Now, for the past 2-ish years, I've been in the gym, and it has been such a good thing for my mind, for my body. I've been much more thoughtful about what I eat and how I just take care of myself. And the older I get, I want to be like more intentional about it. And the idea that you are what you eat is true. And, you know, one of those things for me has been about the snacking. Like, what am I snacking on? Because, Lord, I used to just have the worst snacks. And now, because I'm trying to make sure I get the right amount of protein, I'm trying to make sure my snacks are part of my goals. And that's how I got to Mosh. Mosh, which you might have heard about on Shark Tank, was founded by Maria Shriver and her son, Patrick Schwarzenegger, with a simple mission to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with this debilitating disease. Now, Mosh joined forces with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to go beyond your average protein bar. With 8 delicious flavors, including a plant-based one and peanut butter and chocolate, each Mosh bar is made with ingredients that support brain health like ashwagandha, lion's mane, collagen, and omega-3s. And now Mosh bars come with a new look and a new formulation, featuring a game-changing brain-boosting ingredient you won't find in any other bar. Mosh is now the first and only food boosted with Cognizin, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. But here's the best part to make you feel good. Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Why gender-based? Because 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women. Mosh is working closely to close the gap between women and men's health research. I am just blown away by Mosh bars. They taste good. And again, trying to get that protein and snacking on things that aren't bad for you. This is a big deal. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and your brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/PSTP to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestseller's trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on the bestseller's trial pack at moshlife.com/PSTP. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode. This week, I sat down with author and activist Sandy Hudson to talk about her new book, Defund: Black Lives, Policing, and Safety for All. Her book is fiercely argued, deeply informed. We had a great conversation. Haven't had a guest on in a while who specifically focused on policing, so this was a treat. I'm excited for you to meet Sandy, and here we go. Sandy, it's an honor to have you here on Pod Save the People.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start with your story. What got you to the issue of policing? Did you always know you were going to fight for this issue? Did something happen like it happened to me that was like a thing that, you know, woke you up to the issue? Did you come from a community of organizers and a family of organizers? How did you get to this issue?
Yeah, no, I did not know that this is where I was going to end up at all. I have a background in organizing, and that really stemmed from my education days. I ended up going to the University of Toronto for computer science, for software engineering. That is not what I'm doing right now. And I was having trouble affording that. I didn't come from a wealthy family. And I got involved in activism and advocacy work, literally because I couldn't afford to stay in school, and trying to change that reality for myself and for my community. And when I started doing that activism, I realized so much of how our world is created, set up, is based on wealth inequality and also racial inequality. I started to realize how much Blackness was a part of the way that people are kept out of certain spaces. So my activism began to focus more and more on Black communities. And then, you know, as I was doing that, I started to be more called to do work on the most urgent of our issues. And what is the most urgent of our issues then? The ways our lives are so consistently and persistently interrupted through the carceral system. And so, yes, I did experience some of that for myself in school, actually, during some activism work. And that really opened my eyes to the way that policing interrupts democratic participation, for example, and then experiences that, you know, my family, community members had, and wanting to change that and not feel impotent in the face of those realities.
You know, it's interesting. I spend all of my time on issues of policing, so I know the issue well. And then in reading your book, I was like, you know, actually, I know domestic policing really well. So all the stories about Canada, I'm like, I know nothing about this. I'm like, never heard it, don't know. You know, I've seen clips and stuff. So this was a teaching experience for me. So thank you for that. And, you know, our listeners in the U.S., if you don't know about the Canadian context, you'll learn some of it in the book, which is very cool. I'm interested for you, what was new for you? What did you uncover for yourself in writing this book?
Ooh, that's such a good question. There's two main things that come to mind when I think about that. And, you know, I appreciate your comments, too, on providing that Canadian perspective. I wanted to, you know, doing activism work, I was always connected with activists in the United States and the United Kingdom. And I knew that one of the issues was that we weren't really talking so much about our issues, but the police are integrated across borders. And so I wanted to make sure that people would understand how our issues are linked in together. And I kind of thought I knew about all of the ways that policing showed up in the different jurisdictions, but to see the prevalence of strip searching of children in the United Kingdom, that was a huge piece that I was not expecting to see. The involvement of police in schools, not in a universal way, just like in the United States, just like in Canada, but mostly where Black students tend to be. And the fact that those students are getting strip searched without adult supervision, I was not expecting to see that. And then number two, the other biggest piece that I thought was, you know, such an eye opener was, like, I knew, you know, just as much as I know you know, that there are these cycles that we get into when it comes into policing. You know, an incident happens, then there's a lot of protest. A government or policymakers will be like, let's do a study. And then they'll do a study. They'll come out with recommendations that either sit on a shelf forever, or they'll do like one or two of those recommendations, and then they don't make a difference, but they move on until the next cycle. I was surprised to find that that cycle has been in place since like 1795. I knew it was a long time, but I didn't know it was day one. You know, that was shocking.
That is, you know, when I got this book, I was like, I can't wait to talk to you because I'm interested in how you, you know, defund was the buzzword of the moment in 2020. It was, mm-hmm. you couldn't turn around without experiencing the phrase, people's reaction to it, people's processing of it. And then, you know, we're far, in some ways, it feels very far from 2020. Like just, I'm like, I feel like I've lived 30 lives since that summer. And since the phrase became, and as you know, obviously the backlash to the phrase, I'm interested in how you think about the topics you raise in the book, given this political moment versus the political moment that made the phrase, the title of the book, such a big topic?
You know, I think it's more important now than ever, to be honest. I went back and forth on whether or not to call it in the title Defund, because I knew, you know, like we were moving away from this period where people seemed to be open to, in a way that they hadn't before, considering this. And I knew we were moving into this white lash period, which is, you know, we're deep in the trenches of. But I think for this book, yes, it's for a broad audience, but it's also for people who believe in this, but didn't know how to discuss it. Because I saw people struggling with, you know, I know this is right, but I just don't know how to talk about it. I don't know how to address all of these really hard questions. And so I want to reach those people first and foremost and give them a resource. Like, here are ways that you can talk about it, no matter what jurisdiction you're coming from, what country you're coming from, even. Here are some answers, like concrete answers that you can give to people who are just trying to poke holes in this. And in a moment like now, where people are really squeezed financially, where people are being targeted because they're Black, because they're immigrants, and that is like something that is okay, signed off on by the courts and the administration. Well, we need people to have this background, this knowledge, these strategies, these tactics more than ever. And so, yeah, it's a tough moment, but the tough moment calls for tough preparation.
And one of the things that you write about, and I think I would add this to what you just said, is that there were people struggling to talk about it. And there were people who just didn't know that they were victims of the propaganda. They had no clue that they were repeating talking points that came from police departments, and they just didn't know it originated. Can you talk to us about, and you write about it in the book, but can you talk about the propaganda, the propaganda machine that the carceral state perpetuates and performs?
Yeah, this is like the biggest issue. This is the biggest issue. I was doing an interview just yesterday where it was an interview with a creator who was asking me, like, what's my responsibility? You know, like right now, like when you tell a story about policing, you know, like there's a almost singular way that we tell stories about policing. Yeah, they can have their particularities, but I mean, that is the story that's in our culture. And I was like, but that is propaganda. There used to be a different story that was more typical that people were used to hearing back before 1940. Before 1940, you take a look at like entertainment, you're seeing police on screens, you're seeing like a bumbling police officer who is interrupting your world, interrupting your life, because that is how people saw the police back then. It was a government project, a policing project, and a very, very intentional one to change the way that police were viewed in our society. And so successful that they were able to make these agreements with Hollywood to say, you portray our police like this, and we'll make sure that the permitting is easier for you. To implement legislation like the Hays Code that said you can't show certain types of behavior from police on television. And while that may not be in place today, it certainly created a bedrock of how we were going to be able to talk about police in entertainment moving forward. And
can you talk about the Hays Code for people that don't know?
Sure. Yeah. The Hays Code was a piece of legislation that was implemented in the 1930s that required, the idea of it was that there needed to be a kind of morality to the type of entertainment that Americans were seeing on their screen. And of course, American entertainment, it gets exported around the world. So that is impacting entertainment in all English-speaking countries. And so that included things about how they, you know, the Hays Code didn't want you to see criminals winning or adultery that didn't have consequences. And one of the things that was explicit in the Hays Code was that they wanted people to feel a certain way about crime. They wanted people to feel a certain way about police, that police were good and that crime was bad. And so if you were portraying police on television or in movies, you needed to do so in a way that had the police turning out to be the hero. That was required. And so you add to that the fact that 80% of people are never coming into contact with police, right? This is not like healthcare. This is not like education where everybody has experience. And so their opinions are based off of, in part, experience. Policing, it's not so. But people feel like they know it. People feel like they know policing real well because they feel attached to this thing that they see all the time in entertainment and on the news. And so that propaganda piece, it plays a big, deep role in what people think the police do. Even so far as, and I'm sure you've heard this before, you know, people say, well, what are we going to do when something happens? That's the first thing that people will say, even though, you know, less than 5% of police time is spent on crime. So it shouldn't be the first thing that we're thinking of, right?
It is. I think about things like Paw Patrol. I'm always like struck. I'm like, what a one of the most successful children's shows is Baby Police Officer. You're like
Baby Police.
That is so wild. Or, you know, in the book did such a good setup for this. You know, I would tell people when you see cop shows, they get to hurt as many people as they want to get the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They can decimate communities. But like the idea that anything goes is actually part of the script. And you're like, well, that's sort of a crazy thing when you think about it, you know?
Yeah, it's like it's in the defense of justice. So because it's in the defense of justice, they're just pursuing relentlessly justice. And so, you know, there's some rules that they broke along the way, but who gets harmed? Just the criminals. Well, if that's the mindset you have, then of course we get to a moment like today where we're staring fascism in the eye and the president's like, you know, yeah, sure, we're literally banishing people to countries who didn't do anything. But who cares if we, you know, make a couple mistakes along the way in the pursuit of justice? That's fascism. Okay. That's what that propaganda leads us to. There's a reason why we have the rights that we have and that we should hold on to desperately. And I think it's more clear today than we've seen since 2020.
So I read a lot about the police, and as I said, it's my day job. And I was really heartened to see this section on gender-based violence. I was like, you actually don't see that. You know, people talk about the police in broad strokes, and Lord knows there's enough to talk about that. I get it. And then I saw this, and I was like, come on, including this section on gender-based violence. Can you talk about why you thought that was important to include? Like, what are the takeaways that people need to know?
Oh, yeah, it was so important to me for two reasons. Like, this was two things that inspired that section of the book. One was I've been doing policing work since 2014. And one of the first questions I often get in interviews, and I don't know if it's because I'm a woman, I'm curious if you get this question too, is, well, what are you going to do about rape?
Yes.
Right. So it's almost always the first question I get. What are you going to do about rape? And then my question back would always be like, what are we doing about rape? Like, can you tell me that? Like, what are the police doing about rape? And then the second experience that made it real clear to me that I had to put this in the book was, I have a legal education. I got my JD from UCLA. And I was sitting in a criminal law class, and my professor asked me, you know how law schools are, where it's the Socratic method, and they just call on you and is like, Sandy, Ms. Hudson, what is your favorite theory of punishment was the question. And I said, none of them. I don't believe in punitive approaches. And he said, oh, you sound like you think you're an abolitionist. And I was like, I don't think I'm an abolitionist. I am an abolitionist.
Okay. And he's like, who they let? They don't let anybody into the class.
Right. And then he said to me, he dismissed me so easily. He just said, well, we'll see how you feel once we get to the rape section of the course, and moved on. And I was like, first of all, we're all adults here. I know how I feel. Like, don't do that.
Don't play me like that. Don't do that. No,
don't dismiss me like I haven't thought about this, please. And, you know, just having that experience both in an academic setting and then in the mainstream media, I was like, no. Too many people think this and will use gender-based violence as their justification, will point to, and I don't actually think they're thinking of me. I think that there's this like mythical, like innocent white woman that needs to be protected, that is always sort of plucked out of the air for these sorts of arguments. We need to protect these women. And the crux of the argument in that book is that, number one, that's not happening. The police are not protecting or really engaging in gender-based violence at all. And then number two, we've got this epidemic of missing and murdered Black women, missing and murdered Indigenous women, that, you know, if we wanted to focus on those things, we have to do so much to first of all, understand those issues and then to prevent those issues that we could be focusing on. But we never, hardly ever talk about those issues of safety specifically. It only comes up as a justification for why policing should exist. And it's something like less than a quarter of sexual assaults that are even reported to police, let alone resolved through policing as a strategy for that. So I just needed people to know that, because it comes up so much as a justification.
Now, one of the things that I've been struck by a decade later is that you can tell people all the things, right? You're like, less than 5% of 911 calls. You're like, the police aren't solving rapes anyway. The solve rate for any crime is low. Murder, you know, like, they're not solving much anyway. Mm-mm. And yet people still hold on. What is your, I'm interested in your takeaways 10 years later around, like, what is making people still hold on? Do you think it is the propaganda? Do you think it is they have not seen viable alternatives that they can touch and feel? Do you think it is, like, I don't know, what it, you know, because it is, the police don't even make the best case for themselves. You know, like, they, you know, people just sort of grow up being like, I need the police, but you're like, their own data is not helping them out. And yet,
yeah, people don't know the data. They don't. I think that the impact of propaganda is very, very real. I don't think that people know the data. And there's two other things. One is like the imaginary of what police are, right? People think, okay, if I have a problem, I have a service where I can call my own personal hero. And my own personal hero is going to show up and is going to protect me. And that is a very powerful myth, I think. Because people want to be able to reach out and do something and hold something when something goes wrong. And I've talked to so many people who've had the experience of something going wrong, reaching out for those police and realizing the police don't do anything most of the time when they have that conflict in their lives or that broken sense of safety or trust. Like, they realize, you know, the police didn't do anything for me. Right. And the people who are confronted with that all the time, which is, you know, by and large our community, we know that to some extent. We know that. It's very hard myth to get around, that this idea that this personal hero isn't going to come. And then number two, our entire system's structure supports it. So politicians, I mean, they've been promising to be tough on crime consistently since the 70s in every election round. In every election round. And what does Teflon crime amount to? It amounts to more money for police. Like, what an easy way to promise something to an electorate that feels scared. I'm going to put some more money into the police. We're going to take care of this crime, and we're going to create new policing services. We're going to give more power to this kind of police, whether that be ICE or the DEA or whatever it is in whatever jurisdiction at whatever time. And it's really, really easy for politicians because it lets them off the hook. They never have to actually sit and plan and create the infrastructure and services that actually provide the conditions of safety if they're able to just throw some money to the police. And that structure being there, that system being there, is very, very strong, because then the politicians and policymakers can continue to promise that as the solution. And it just reinforces that myth that we feel like, okay, well, crime is going to be taken care of so long as there's police. And that equals safety.
It is interesting, too, when you meet people who become radicalized by the inaction of the police, not even like the failure, just like they didn't do a thing. Like, you know, people's car gets stolen and you think it's CSI and they are like, write the report and they go home. You're like, you didn't dust for fingerprints? They're like, we don't do that. You know, like, we don't. And then you're like, you think you getting the CSI and they are like, call me if you find the person. You're like, you the police.
Yeah. So in my hometown right now, like I live in LA, but in my hometown's Toronto. In my hometown in Toronto, Canada, there's a massive car theft ring happening. It's like a huge issue.
Is it the Kia boys or is it something else?
Yes, it's like the Kia and whatever. Okay, so what's the other car? There's one other car that's like getting
I know what you're talking about. Yes.
And it's like a huge issue. And so finally the police had to like make a statement on it. And their thing was, if you see your car being stolen, just let it happen.
And you're like, not
the statement that they put out to the population. Just let it happen and file a report. And then what? Like people were like, and then what? It's just like, what are you here for? What are you actually here for then? Like, I don't understand.
My friend's house got broken into the other day and she was dropping her kid off and got an alert being like, somebody's moving around the house. So she gets home, people are gone, police come, and they're like, you should probably get the camera fixed. That's like that's the only feedback they provide her. Mm-hmm. She's like, do y'all have like, and they're like, no, but if you find out something, call us. And she's like, well, I could have done this by myself. You're like, yeah.
Exactly. You know,
like, yes.
Exactly.
It's interesting to see. I'd be interested in how have you experienced leaders in the past decade? So, you know, it's one thing to talk to community members. It's another thing to talk to policymakers and elected officials. And you know, I have seen I've just seen all types of people since the past decade, the way people engage in this issue. I'd be interested in what you've seen.
I mean, there's so many ways to answer that question. So I'm curious about what you're getting at, because I've heard some of your, critiques.
So I'd be curious. You tell me. No, you know, I think that like off the record, I see like police chiefs off the record get it more than I thought they did. They're not willing to fight the police officers in public, but offline, they're like, yeah, I get it. You know what I mean? I'm like, okay. Or like even legislators, when I talk to city council people today or mayors off the record, they're like, yeah, that was crazy. But like the people are scared about crime, so I need to vote for this thing, but I know it doesn't work. Mm. Whereas I thought I was going to come in the room and people were going to be like full-fledged, like the police are the people saving the. And that's actually not what I'm seeing as much as I thought I was going to see, interestingly. But I don't know if that's what you're seeing.
Okay. Yeah. In my experience, there are policymakers and leaders who are on our side. They know. They've seen the data. They work with it directly. In fact, they fully are aware. In fact, you know, the Toronto Police Board, I remember talking to members of the police board about the issue of police in schools. You know, we'd been working on that campaign for a long time with a whole bunch of different community members, and them being like, we're on your side. Like, we get it. Like, what you're saying is true. Kids should not be handcuffed in the classroom. These kids should not be subject to surveillance and interrogation like they are being. And then we get into the police board meeting where it's like the first preliminary vote to investigate, like not even to just do it, to investigate the program. And they all turn on us. They have no political courage. And from that to talking to someone who would later become the mayor of my hometown, who was like, "Yeah, we're trying to change policing, and we're gonna get these budgets down, and we're gonna reallocate some of this budget to." And no, instead, we see that political courage disappear when they get in power, when money gets involved, and they change their tune. And so that has been really, really frustrating, because there are people throughout the apparatus who know. I mean, they see the numbers like we see the numbers. They know it's not working. They know policing is a sham. But it is, again, I feel like it's so easy for these leaders and policymakers to just have something to throw money at to say that they're working on a problem, rather than doing the harder, like it takes years to build good infrastructure to take care of a social issue. And I don't think our political landscape right now, with the way that it is so captured by big money, is interested in doing that. And that's like, we deserve better than that, do we not? I think people deserve better than that.
I think the courage thing is spot on. It's like, they know better. They just are. And I do think that so few people, this is part of the courage thing, are willing to have the police disagree with them in public. Like, they don't want the police to come out and be like, "I don't agree with Senator Sandy." You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. they are freaked mm-hmm. out about that. Mm-hmm. As we close, you are in the same political world I'm in, where people are freaked out. It's like ICE is it is so much. People are both checked out because they're overwhelmed by the chaos. People are scared. And, this is a moment where I think people's hope is challenged. I think some people are energized, but I think people's hope is challenged. Mm-hmm. What do you say to the people whose hope is challenged in moments like this?
Oh, my goodness. The key here is to not get isolated. That is the key. This works. Fascism works if you feel alone and scared and you are not connecting with other people. If you don't know who your neighbors are, if you don't know who people, where people are at that can help and support you, right? That's the only way that this works. If you feel connected to people in a way that allows you to fight back, that allows you to go into those community town hall meetings and not be afraid because you got people behind you and you can shout down your representative and say, like, "We're not standing for this, like we're seeing some people doing." If you are connected with people and that allows you to get out into the streets with bigger and bigger numbers, the bigger the numbers, the more safe that you are, right? Like, that's the thing that we need. And, I've been doing activism for a long time. I've been at protests where there's 10 people, and I've been at protests where there's tens of thousands of people, right? Like, one is going to energize you and take you to the next one, and to help you feel hope at a time where it feels like hope is in such short supply. And there's nothing more helpful to that than being connected in community. So I really encourage people, like, if nothing else, to not experience that fear and anxiety just by yourself, to get out there and be connected as much as possible, even as we're staring down some of the worst that we've seen. I just don't get isolated.
Where do people go to stay in touch with you? Is it Twitter? Is it Facebook? Is it Instagram? Is it Blue Sky? Is it none of the above?
We don't do Twitter no more. I mean,
Twitter is barely doing Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. I'm on Blue Sky, and that's Sandela, Sandela. Or you can find me on Instagram, which is where I'm most active, which is Sandy M. Hudson.
What's the M? Wait, can I guess? Wait, what's the second letter of what's the second letter of the M?
Oh, you'll be able to guess without a second letter. Come on.
Oh, is it like Melissa?
Oh, God,
Marie?
No.
Yeah. Sandy Marie?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. I don't know why I just wanted to give you a little Melissa. I was like, let me give her a little.
Marie is like such the obvious. Everybody.
I know, but I was. But you know, black people can be creative. So I was like, Sandy, but
that is true. That is true. I am Jamaican though. So there's a shrunken amount of options, I feel like, when you're Jamaican. And Marie is one of them.
I love it. Well, we can see your friend of the pod. I can't wait to have you back.
Oh, thank you. And I'd love to be back. I think that you folks are doing really great work. I like listening to your podcast and I appreciate you having me on and the work that you do.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.